This is the Paula Gordon Show, Conversations with People at the Leading Edge. It is a great pleasure and honor, I must say, to be with John Dean, who has not only played a very important part in American history before, has become really very current again as he looks toward what he calls broken government. We were talking as we went away, Bill Russell, thank you, for the last 7 years since the Bush administration was appointed by the Supreme Court, not elected, we have seen a sharp degradation of the American people being represented. We have seen special interests as sort of the common term, but we have seen a very big change in what America has been. America started in the deepest sense as a liberal country, going all the way back, and you do a wonderful job in Broken Government and going back and saying what the predicates are and what was really intended. But what I found, in addition to being depressed as I read that, I kept putting in the margin, they cheat, they lie, they cheat. What do you do when you have a system that not only can be gamed, but people are perfectly happy, eager to cheat?
It's, you know, what's interesting is conservatives once were such sticklers for the rules. They prided themselves on their adherence to playing by the game's proper procedures. That's not the truth anymore. From everything from the way they will run government to, as you know, in one of the appendix, I thought it was so important to explain how they are intellectually dishonest and make arguments that are fallacious, and but yet arguments that are being based on or serving the basis for the nation to go into war, for torture, for illegal wiretapping, very radical rulings where it, proving the adage you can always find a lawyer to give you an opinion on anything you want, which shouldn't be the case with the federal government. It didn't used to be the case with the federal government. But you're right, there is a looseness about it.
We wouldn't allow our children to act this way. How is it that we allow the people who are nominally representing us?
Well, the answer is most people aren't aware of it. Those who are, there are two groups. Obviously there are the partisans who cannot see beyond their own leaders doing what they think is best.
And you call those leaders authoritarian?
Well, I do. I did a book that preceded this. This is actually the third in a trilogy of books of sort of post-Watergate Republican rule in Washington. And it's not because I have an axe to grind about Republicans in particular. It's not because I'm trying to make Watergate look good. I've never been known as a Watergate apologist.
No, not hardly.
I do realize the first of those books, which I called Worse Than Watergate, it was actually a misnomer. It should have been much worse than Watergate because nobody was tortured during Watergate. Nobody was killed during Watergate under the so-called Watergate abuses. Millions of people weren't subject to electronic surveillance under Watergate. I mean, it's just, you know, it's minor as you compare the two events. But anyway, in pulling this book together, my thought was that by providing information to people, I happen to believe you give the public the solid information, the things they don't know about, they'll make the right decision. I think the classic example I've seen is the jury system, where if you take 12 citizens from very different walks of life, very different levels of education, you put them in a jury room after giving them an awful lot of information and some rules with which to follow to make a decision, they will make the right decision 99 out of 100 times. It's a remarkable thing.
It's same called true. Democracy.
Well, the same is true. It's a many form of... People have always told me how they groan, you know, when they get their notice for jury service. I said, don't feel that way. It's probably going to... If you know, you can get some terribly dull cases, but sometimes it's a really interesting personal experience the way democracy really works. And it's there, it's even more than just majority rules. You have to have unanimity in a jury. And to get that as often as does happen is quite remarkable, that 12 people can agree on something where the stakes are often terribly high.
I interrupted you with the authoritarian issue, but it seems to me that that is critical in thinking about where we are and how we got there. Bill?
Well, there, in the subject of authoritarianism, you talk about Congress and the problems. You also say that it's on its way sort of to getting fixed by virtue of the Democrats reassuming control of it, though there's still a lot of challenges and a lot of damage has been done. With respect to the executive and with respect to the judiciary, you introduced and went into depth on issues that I was aware of, but I had no idea how dangerous they are. One is in the executive branch is this wonderland that is the unitary executive.
Unitary executive theory.
And I want you to go into that. And the other, of course, is what you characterize as the fundamentalism on the Supreme Court and in the federal judiciary. But, you know, let's take these apart. Let's deal with the executive first.
Well, I think the first time any American, including many members of the Senate, ever heard of the unitary executive or the unitary executive theory was when Bush nominated Alito to become a justice of the Supreme Court, because he happened to have given a speech where he embraced the unitary executive theory. What is this odd term? Well, it's been, I think, fairly accurately described as the imperial presidency on stilts with steroids, and that's very much what it is. It really starts, it's something that was cooked up by a bunch of bright lawyers during the Reagan years in the Department of Justice to try to get control within the executive branch of all the regulatory agencies and that are theoretically independent regulatory agencies and departments, where the president could make all the calls and everything had to filter up through the White House. Don't rely on a cabinet. Don't rely on an independently appointed person. In fact, what I find interesting about Greenspan's silence during his time as the chairman of the Federal Reserve, which is probably the preeminent independent agency, is that he goes over and complains to the Bush Department, he's now telling us in his memoir, and they won't listen to him about fiscal responsibility. They won't veto anything.
That's pretty basic.
For a government. He lets them, he embraces, in essence, a tax cut that only takes care of a very few very rich Americans who don't need any help, thank you. But anyway, he is, in a sense, embracing the unitary executive, because rather than using the power he had to go out and publicly speak, because if you recall, when Greenspan was chairman, America listened, particularly Wall Street. And if he had come out of one of his meetings and said, listen, a tax cut now is a terrible idea. This spending bill is a disaster. We're spending, we've got trillions going into Iraq. We can't be doing this, that, and the other thing. It would have kiboshed it. I'm telling you, it would have done it.
And that was irresponsible of him.
It was irresponsible, but it's typical of the unitary executive, where the president makes the call and nobody peeps.
Except in this administration, it's the vice president who makes the call, and the front man is the spokesperson.
That's another story.
And a very important story.
I tell in some detail.
Indeed.
This unitary executive, this country was founded really out of the Enlightenment, out of a sense of evidence-based thinking,
reason,
science, but really evidence. And this unitary executive...
And experience.
And experience, absolutely. Thank you. This unitary executive is pre-Enlightenment. These people, they sort of make up things that the Constitution doesn't say, and it really feels like it predates the Enlightenment. That it's people sitting around having theories. Very bright people,
feudal,
as you point
monarchy
out.
Comes to
exactly the word.
It's and making it up. Well, exactly. I mean, it's not a unitary executive. It's it's a proto proto. It's a monarchy.
Now, those who didn't like the so-called imperial presidency, when they begin to understand the implications of the unitary executive, which I try to lay out in some detail in the book. All the book, my editor, if you will, my first editor, my first reader, is my wife Maureen. And if she says, "Oh, that's technical, that's dull, that's," I have to clean it up or remove it.
It's never dull. It's like reading a mystery. How's it going to come out?
But if I get too textbookish or too legalistic, she's very good at screening that stuff and doctoring. So I don't try to dumb it down by any stretch of the imagination, because that would, to me, be an insult to the reader.
Unlike most of America's media.
Yes, they do dumb down often. And the 8th or 9th grade they're writing for now in the average American newspaper. Which has been one of the things that the internet does nicely, is at least they'll speak to somebody who they figure is intelligent enough to understand what they're saying.
Okay.
We've gotten on a diversion here.
The diversion, I think, is at the heart of what we're talking about.
I want to be clear about this, because there's been a great deal of discussion. There have been articles written in law reviews, which you do a lovely job of explaining is not a particularly impressive thing to have happen, which I simply did not know.
Isn't that a phenomenal? Yeah.
It is. But it's, you know, there's this sort of, I mean, it is very clever propaganda.
Indeed, thank you for that word.
And these people have done an excellent job of propagandizing, but if one looks behind the curtain, there's no there there. The theory on which this unitary executive is based simply doesn't hold water.
Whole cloth, just invented. There is no, you know, it harks back to the Federalist Papers, where there is the expression of the desire to have a unitary executive. Well, what was that really all about? It was to not have a council of three or four people in the executive branch. Didn't say that unitary executive, or that sole chief executive, would control everything that the Congress thereafter created, when they deliberately created independent regulatory agencies like the Federal Communications Commission, the Securities and Exchange Commission, the Federal Reserve. There's a whole litany of those types of agencies that these unitarians would have you adopt and say the president can dictate their policy and make their decision.
Well, and it effectively eviscerates both the courts and the legislature. Which is,
or subsumes them in this instance.
Well, exactly. Whichever, but it, you know, clearly, it's extraordinarily difficult for a layperson to make sense of the arguments, other than just willfulness and essentially rationalizing what they want to do.
Right, and you know, even viewers.
And there's a theological. It almost feels theological in this.
Right. I have to work on the assumption that not everybody pays attention to the Supreme Court confirmation hearings, where newspapers were actually forced to try to explain the unitary executive, which they didn't really get at that point. This is a weird term. It's so innocuous and so technical. People get it when you say imperial president. They know what they have a sense of what that is. Unitary executive, that's such a meaningless term, but yet so much is being done under that umbrella.
And calling it an imperial presidency seems almost generous. It's an imperium. The president part is just, you know, sort of an afterthought. But this is someone who the individual is going to assume full authority, though not responsibility.
Well, you know, you say the individual, and that's one of the things that worries me about 2008 and the hereafter, because what happened is the presidency isn't one man. It really is a whole collection. And when the next president comes in, let's say it's another Republican, which I shudder at the thought of, because this presidency, the last 8 years, has spent an awful lot of time trying not just to worry about the political appointees it puts in to run departments and agencies, but absolutely ignoring the civil service laws and placing people down within the bureaucracy, embedding them in there because they think the way they want them to think. And this is going to be a long time before that changes. And you take something like the Office of Legal Counsel, which is theoretically the president's law firm. It's not the White House counsel's office. The legal work's done over at the Department of Justice. Yes, we have our own legal staff as counsel, but you really rely on a small law firm that has one job, and that is to serve the president, to answer highly technical questions about how he can execute the laws properly. That's roughly 22 lawyers, 24 sometimes, what have you, small group. They have now been, as a result of, from Rehnquist on, so many conservatives, even during, to my surprise, even during the Clinton administration, they didn't take a radical departure. They didn't try to undo everything that was sitting there, because Bill Clinton was a centrist, and he'll say, well, I'll take what I want, I won't. He took, for example, the unitary executive theory and used it against the conservatives. They wanted it to regulate and reduce regulation of business. Clinton said, well, that's interesting.
The sword cuts both ways.
Exactly. It cuts both ways to the chagrin of conservatives, where he was using it to impose new health and safety standards on businesses that he could do it because he now had a unitary power.
This is the Paula Gordon Show. John Dean is our guest. We'll be back shortly. Let me leave it at that.